I ask if you thought he was fair
He
in his
was very
coverage.
fair in this respect, and that is, he was a tremendous listener, and he was 100% truthful in what he heard. When he reported on what you told him, it was as exact as he could be. But with reference to bringing yourself around to being, shall I say, pro-Jewish, I don't want to say that, although some of his most famous editors and so on were Jewish. And as a matter of fact, the chairman of the board, C.D. Jackson, was a Jew. Oh. Time in life. Oh. Later married the widow of Sulzberger of the New York Times, whom I knew very well. I used to report to the editors, you know, all the time. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to get back to some of my activities in Pittsburgh. And some of my Jewish activities. I arrived in Pittsburgh after I graduated Yale Law School. I arrived in September of 1921. And I arrived here as a result of the fact that my closest friend at Yale, classmate, was Charles Rosenblum, who was one of the finest human beings I ever knew, and who was my closest friend, like a brother, all his life.
I think you told us about that last time.
Yeah.
Yes.
When I came to Pittsburgh, I immediately interested myself in public causes, Jewish and non-Jewish. For example, in those days, there were company towns in Pittsburgh, and the people who worked in these company towns for the steel companies and the coal companies and so on were little better than peons. They didn't dare raise their voices for any kind of trade unionism or better working conditions or anything like that. And since I was interested in all of these things, I made a couple of public speeches on these subjects, and I was then sought after when some of these workers, laborers, disappeared. Their wives came to me and said they'd said something about working conditions or about organizing. They were arrested and thrown in jail and so on. And I, with my legal training and so on and so forth, would go there and say to the superintendent, Salvation Coal Company or something like that, you better get that guy out of there because, you know, I'll have you in court tomorrow. I used to get them out. And little by little, when working with that, these company towns were abolished in Pennsylvania and so on and so forth. But that was on that score. But I was interested in things Jewish right in the very, very beginning and so on. And Saul Rosenblum, Charles Rosenblum's father, was a very highly educated and very deeply motivated man vis-a-vis Jewish life everywhere. He was the president of the Tree of Life Synagogue, and so was his son Charles. And Charles was also head of the Institute and things of this kind. On the local scene, I have been president of the Pittsburgh Zionists first. I have been a member of the board of practically every Jewish organization. That is the YMHA, the Federation, the Jewish Home for the Aged. And I'd like to say this, that I was the chairman of the campaign, men's chairman. They only had men's chairman those days. In 1938, 50 years ago, I was the chairman of the drive and so on. And so I was very, very active in all these things. So was my wife. My wife was a life member of the Board of Trustees of the Montefiore Hospital. Also a member of all these other organizations that I mentioned. But, and Jewish Social Service Bureau. We were on all of them. But my wife and I both, I was a member of the board of the Pittsburgh Chamber Music Society, for example. And my wife was also a board member of the Chamber of Music Society. My wife was a member of the board of Child Guidance Center. And half of the other local aides, I can't think of what they are right now, all dealing with social and economic problems. We were always involved all of our lives in all of these things. But anyway...
I think you told us of some of these on our last interview, but I think what we would love to hear from you is maybe how some of these things have changed over the years, or even your perceptions in the last 10 years.
Well, I'm very glad you bring that up, because things are entirely different. I think when I was the chairman of then it was called the Federation campaign, I think we went out for $160,000, and now it's $8 million, something like that. And, of course, we only had local chair. We didn't have any Israeli things. We weren't incorporated in the local. It was the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies in those days. All the other things had their little separate drives. Like there was a little drive for the university, a little drive for the Jewish National Fund, and all of these. By the way, I was many, many years on the board of the Weizmann Institute in Jerusalem. See, I'm one of the founders of the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. And my name's carved in the walls in there. We have given many paintings. Our best, please believe me, have gone to Tel Aviv Museum. Because Tel Aviv Museum antedates. As a matter of fact, when the State of Israel was created, my best Dutch painting I gave to the Tel Aviv Museum.
What was the
painting
best?
By Averkamp. Oh. Henrik von Averkamp. It's a very famous painting. It's a hockey game between the Guelphs and the Ghibellines or something like that, you know, in those days. And they're all dressed in costume and so on. And at the Tel Aviv Museum, if you go, they have a room for 17th century Dutch. That's the Rembrandt period, you know. Mm-hmm. That one we gave them by Albert Combs, right, the one right in the middle. You'll see it given by Anna Longo. And we gave it also a 17th century Dutch painting to Yale, to the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, when they founded the Israel Museum. And we've also given one of those 17th century Dutch to Fogg Museum in Harvard, because both my kids went to Harvard, you know. But I think I don't want to mention to you, but I mentioned to you that you saw in there, I've given the National Museum in Washington. We've given paintings to the Metropolitan Museum and to many museums, of course the Carnegie Museum here, many things in the Frick Fine Arts here and the other museums throughout the United States. And we've shown paintings from our collection, Museum of Modern Art, Boston Museum, all the great museums of America, Museum of Modern Art, all of them. But anyway, that was all part of my upbringing, as it were.
We were talking about some of the changes.
Oh, yes, some of the changes. Well, as I said, I remember when I first came here, the Jewish Center was down on Center Avenue, somewhere way down. And so was the Montefiore Hospital down there.
Right.
And I had a hand, as a matter of fact, when they built the Jewish Center here on Belfield, I worked in the campaign for raising the money for that. Sam Mundheim, who was the president of Kaufman's at the time, he was married to a Kaufman. He was the chairman of the campaign and so on. But I worked very close with Dinger Kaufman all his life, and I knew him very, very well and so on. And so that changed, and now we moved from there into the new Jewish Center. In my opinion, the Jewish Center never should have been down here, because it's not in the middle of Jewish life or anything like that. Secondly, they made the biggest...
In Oakland.
That's right. And they never had a parking lot. Now, of course, in those days, automobiles were coming in already, see, but they had no way of taking care of the parking. I've seen this whole district. Matter of fact, we were the bankers for Webster Hall, for the building of Webster Hall, and many apartment houses and so on and so forth. But anyway, the Jewish institutions have changed so at the budget, any one of them, like the Jewish Social Service today, or of course, not, I'm not speaking of the Jewish Home for the Aged, which in those days was a local, now it's part of the United Fund, you know, and so on and so forth. And where in those days, the annual budget was $100,000, now in the $4 or $5 million and so on and so forth. And by the way, I like to say that when the State of Israel was created, a group of us Jewish leaders in the whole United States decided that the Zionist movement had fulfilled its purpose in the creation of the state. And because in the years 42 to the time the state's created, 48, 49, so many non-Zionists became our biggest contributors, you know, because to save the Jews and so on and so forth. And they didn't mind because Palestine was the only place they could go to and so on and so forth. And they had changed their anti-Zionist position. I was the national chairman of a group put together to abolish the Zionist organization. We thought they had fulfilled, very successfully fulfilled their function. Mm-hmm. And I'm still opposed to it. I'm not a member of the Zionist organization. But I was the national chairman of the group of all these leaders, with not Zionists, Zionists and non-Zionists, but they were big contributors of the Friends from Friends of Israel. The only thing is the war was taking place then in the 1947 to 51, 52, and
what
so
you,
on.
What had you envisioned instead of a
we
Zionist
wanted, we wanted to create
Israel.
A Friends of Israel.
And
as American
how
Jews should just give Israel what it needs, regardless of what it is, and not
okay.
take part in the Zion, the general ZOA, or general Zionists, and the labor Zionists, the religious Zionists, women Zionists, Hadassah, and so on and so forth.
How did the Arabs living there fit into
that?
How did the Arabs who lived in Israel fit into this picture of the Friends of Zionism?
No, the Friends of Israel.
The Friends of Israel.
It has nothing to do with Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
It's only the Jews
okay.
who were the great supporters, were the Zionists and Hadassah
okay.
and the Poalei Tzion and the Mizrahi,
mm-hmm.
all these various aspects of Jewish life. See?
Oh, I see. So you wanted
one of them, all to become Friends of Israel.
And
I
to
wanted
promote
much more than that. I wanted all those who never belonged to Zionist organizations,
mm-hmm.
who were very large contributors, and small contributors also, but for the benefit of the State of Israel, for Jews, I wanted that seat.
But you still wanted it to be an Israeli
nation? No, I wanted it called friend. Oh, the
Jewish
State
nation?
Of Israel was created already.
Okay.
You see, when the State of Israel was created, I said the Zionist organization had fulfilled and succeeded in their function. Their function was to create the State of Israel. And the State of Israel was created, you see. Once it was created, I felt the new institutions had to be organized. I was much more interested, for example, in having the Hebrew University have a drive over here, or the Israel Museum, or the American Israel Cultural Foundation, or the Weizmann Institute. All of those, yes, that's okay for special items of support, don't just need. But I wanted everybody to be Friends of Israel. I didn't want it to be on a, shall I say, from an economic point of view, a conservative, ZOA is conservative, they call them general Zionists.
Mm-hmm.
The labor Zionists in Israel are socialists.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in control of the government all the time, from Ben-Gurion
mm-hmm.
on until Begin,
mm-hmm.
until 7 or 8 years ago. They were in control of all the government socialists. And I was very much in sympathy with their economic and political philosophies. And I had plenty of trouble. I was on the National Executive Committee of the Zionist Organization of America, because predominantly here in America, we worked politically toward the creation of the state.
Mm-hmm.
That was our main important point. Once the state was created, we didn't have to work politically anymore for the creation of the state, don't you see? And so I was very anxious to get mobilized Jews of America aiding Israel, but not taking part, not backing the insiders of the Labor Party or the Heirut or any of these other parties that they had in Israel, see?
Mm-hmm.
And the ZOA, as you know, only backs the Zionists, the general Zionists. The labor Zionists are entirely separate, and the religious Zionists are entirely separate. And they have their American counterpart. I think it's ridiculous. Today, I'm just as opposed to it. It's 40 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we gave up our abandoned our idea, Israel was in so much need because in the first 2 years, you know, the state, that's starting 51 I'm talking about, but the state gets a little big. They took in 750,000 a year from all these other countries and so on and so forth. And the absorption problem became such a fantastic problem that I didn't want to divide Jews anymore. And so, oh, the hell with it. We'll go ahead with the organization they have, but we'll create the UJA. Then I had a great problem with the UJA because the federations, which happen in every one of the community, the Jewish federations, offer local Jewish causes like the hospital home for the aged, mm-hmm. social services, so on and so forth, Hebrew schools and students. They organized the American Council Federations, Council Jewish Federation and Welfare Fund. Mm-hmm. And the Council Jewish Federation and Welfare Fund said to them, we are the fundraising body for Jews in America, and so on, and UJA will just be another one of the beneficial agencies. Well, I was the national head of the committee on UJA to save the UJA, and the UJA is the most important of all, and the rest benefit by the fact that UJA represents such the interest in giving is UJA, don't you see? And so now they're parts of us. It says of us being part of them. I'm talking about UJA now. See. I was a national chairman of that.
Excuse me, you said who is part of what? The UJA is?
The Council of Jewish Federation of Welfare Fund wanted to make UJA just another one of its agencies.
I see.
We had UJAs. Oh, no, we're UJA. Okay.
So the Council of UJA is now a part of UJA?
No. Oh. Yeah, they have a working agreement, and that is that it started out about 85% of all the money raised went to Israel. See, now it's about 60%. See, and then and that's justly so because I think that since the state has been created, so much more has to be done in America among us Jews. A, to remain Jews. B, to educate us for being Jews. B, to see that we're supported, that we have all the agencies, social agencies, homes for the aged, and hospitals, and so on and so forth, to remain good Jews. And much more important, Aliyah. Much more important, because you can't have Aliyah unless the Jews are intense. If they're intense, they'll go to Israel. They have to be intense. And this has always been my thinking, and it's still my thinking.
Were you sorry you never made Aliyah?
It's just the biggest mistake of my life. I don't have a pad, at least in Israel, in Jerusalem. In the first place, which I think is the most interesting city in the world anyway, that I know of. I know most of the big cities. Because the cosmopolitanism of Jerusalem beats any place I know of. Exciting. But anyway.
And this is from a world traveler.
Well, I can
it's
tell
an
you,
exciting
right, it's
place.
The finest. It has everything. It has absolutely everything. And as I said, that's one of the great regrets of my life, is that I don't live there. I have a house there, I have a pad there. I don't know why. I have the excuse. I'm ashamed of it. I should have been there always. But I know I would have experienced exactly what a lot of American Jews did, and it broke their hearts. We were still outsiders.
In Israel.
In Israel, you bet. Now, for example, let me give you an illustration of what just happened. And I want to record this, what happened. At the upcoming elections this November, Abba Eban is not on the labor list. Not even on the list. The list is 61 people. He's not on the list. He used to be third on the list, fourth on the list, and so on and so on. Why isn't he on the list? He's the most able foreign interpreter, a foreign relations man Israel ever had. He's done more than almost anybody from the point of view of foreign aid and all this kind of stuff for the state of Israel. But you know, he's an outsider. He was born in South Africa. When he was a little boy, his father died and his mother moved to London. His schooling is English at Cambridge and so on and so forth. He earned it. He earned his position with Ben Gurion, see. But now 40 years have gone by, and it's like in American politics. If you want to be on the list, you know, to be somebody there, you got to have a constituency. You got to start at the bottom, work yourself up to the labor movement, you know, and so on and so forth. He didn't have that, and they dropped him just now. Of course, he's almost 80 years old, but they dropped him. 61 names to put on the list, not to have room for Abba Eban. And of course, I realized they'd have to put him amongst the first five or six. You can't take a guy like Eban and put him down there. 60, they have 61, saying something like that. But they dropped him completely. I think Eban made a mistake. I think Eban should have realized that he doesn't have a constituency. And he should have said, please don't put me on. Please, you've honored me enough. I've done all I can do for the state. I've been in this wonderful high position and so on and so forth. Then they would have been all kinds of kudos paid to him. And so, that's why they dismissed him, you know.
For one of the last things that we want to discuss today is you've been so privileged to be at the inception and the planning and before the beginning of the State of Israel and have witnessed 40 years of history with her and with many of its leaders. What are some of the things you never envisioned would happen, and what do you see for the future?
Well, the first thing that I must tell you about my disappointment. And my disappointment is a personal disappointment in this respect. The State of Israel was created, the Zionist philosophy was, that we're going to create a state of Jews for Jews. And the Jews would do every line of endeavor. And it would be a collective system. Not a communist system, but a collectivist system with kibbutzim, moshavim, and no foreign. You wouldn't employ foreigners. We'd find Jews at every level who would do everything from the worst, from the simplest, because there are Jews who are simple, to the most educated, scientific, high-tech, and so on. When Jews developed their economic base through the school system in the first generation, and particularly through the army, because the army is the real leveler and the real educator in Israel, because everybody has to serve in the army, with the exception of Orthodox Jews, who beg out on religious reasons. But Jews became too rapidly educated, and the Jews began to employ Arabs. And in the kibbutzim, the kibbutz became a private corporation, and it hired the people that it could hire cheap, although they paid them the minimum wage. And the Jews moved higher and higher. They did all the high tech, all the highly educated, all the highly skilled things the Jews did. Today, every day, 200,000-300,000 Arabs come in from the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, or Jordan, and do all, like, in quotation, the dirty work. They build the roads, they are the maids, they're this kind of thing, and so on and so forth. The fact of the matter is that if they were to stop working, the state would collapse. They build all the buildings. They do all this kind of hard work, you know, and so on and so forth. This I never envisioned, and this I'm disappointed in. I realized it would have, some of it would have to happen, but I didn't think it would be done on such a large scale. Whereas the welfare of the state depends upon it. Depends upon it. In the agriculture, in the field, all the so-called hard work.
Alex, what do you think that the Arabs should have been doing in that particular state they were living there? You know.
Well, there are two things. First, you have to make a distinction between two kinds of Arabs.
No, I'm talking about the Arabs who were there.
First, what I want to talk about. The State of Israel itself, and as citizens of the State of Israel, there are 650,000 Arabs who are actual citizens of the State of Israel. Mm-hmm. And this is another thing, a great mistake, I think, Israel made. And that is, the Arab citizen of Israel is a full citizen, accepting he doesn't serve in the army. Mm-hmm. I believe he should have served in the army, but they didn't trust him. And there are many good reasons why they shouldn't trust him, believe me. I don't trust them either. But I think we have to do things even when we don't trust. Maybe we can work them out of it. I think if they went through the military system of Israel, they would have learned much more about the life of Jews, much more about what they're aiming for. Their ideals would have gone up even, and so on. And they would have been educated more, because it's in the army that really makes them good, you know, and so on. I think that's one of the great mistakes. Secondly, there's a certain loyalty that develops. When you serve in the army, there's a certain loyalty that you develop. The Arabs, I'm not talking about the Arab citizens of Israel. I'm not talking about the West Bank or the Gaza Strip now. See, I'm talking about them themselves. See? Now, there's no doubt that the Arab citizens of Israel have the highest standard of living of any Arabs anywhere. Now, I'm not talking about the king of Saudi Arabia. You're talking about Saudi Arabians, you know. They're all slaves, see. But anyway, to me, this was a great mistake, but I think a much bigger mistake was exploiting the Arabs by the Jews, and I think they do. I think that's a mistake. And I think one of the main reasons I went Aliyah, there weren't enough Jews coming in. That was another thing where the Jews of the world fell down. We thought the moment the state is created, the Jews will rush. Well, they didn't rush. And particularly from the United States. And I think in the United States, because the Zionist program, all those who were deeply interested, did not take, if they followed me, and we created Friends of Israel, and with emphasis on Aliyah, emphasis on Americans going over there, and enlarging it, see, that's what I wanted more than anything else. And I still do. I don't know how I'm going to do it. I'm terribly scared that the only thing it'll ever do will be another kind of a Holocaust or a threat or anti-Semitism. This is not the kind I want. I want them to go because it's better to go.
What do you think the future holds?
I don't know. I wish I did know. I think it's getting a little bit better, but not much. There is no Aliyah of any size at all. The only hope is that maybe out of Russia, a couple of million, but then most of the Russians are coming, Russian Jews are coming to the United States.
What directions do you think, as American Jews, we should encourage?
Well, we've never, for example, I've never been able, as a matter of fact, for the recent Congress in Jerusalem, some of my friends who are in leadership positions in the Zionist organization, I asked them, please do away with your Zionist organization. Please do away with the Jewish agency.
Excuse me, I don't think we heard the first answer. Please do away with what?
Zionist organization.
Oh, I see.
Please do away with the Jewish agency. Please let Israel absorb. We should send them over. But let Israel, it's a state. This is the duty of a state. It's a government. It has taxes. It absorbs. And we should bring them over, maybe giving the initial amount for housing or for the first 3 months of welfare over there, you know. But it's the duty of the government of Israel. It should be integrated into the function of Israel immediately.
Thank you.
Well, that's what I feel very strongly about. Well, I have to go to the bathroom. I got a couple.
Well, fine. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Wow.
I want you to talk one of you about my function with reference to the development of Judaism.